Good morning. It is 7:43 here on the Mighty 690, and it is time for our monthly chat with U.S. Representative Derek Schmidt, who joins us on the line. Good morning, sir. How's it going?
Good morning, James. Going well, thanks. Great to be back with you.
Absolutely. Hope you had a good 4th and a good Independence Day since we last talked.
Thank you. It was terrific. I was all over the district on the 4th and saw some fireworks, had some parades. It was a very, very good celebration.
Fantastic. Well, that is great. Let's get right into it, because I know still there's quite a few things going on Capitol Hill. And starting off first, wanted to ask you a little bit about something called the Stop Insider Trading Act. I understand you're a co-sponsor of that, and that passed out of the House here this week.
Yes, that's true. This is the whole issue about whether members of Congress can own individual stocks. And the concern, of course, is that by definition, you have access as a member of Congress to information that's not yet public. And so it's always possible, I mean, everybody's human, even if you try your best, you can't wall off one part of your brain from another, so you tend to know things that could influence the value of a stock. And so insider trading, of course, is already illegal, including for members of Congress, but there's just sort of this inherent risk whenever a member of Congress is able to buy and sell individual stocks. Not really an issue with mutual funds and things like that, where somebody else is managing, you know, what's in the bundle. But it is where you're picking and choosing, buy this stock, sell that stock. I know this is about to happen, so sell that. And there have been some horror stories. You know, the one that made the headlines mostly in recent years is former Speaker Pelosi, who has somehow managed to become a very wealthy person while serving a long, long time in the United States House of Representatives. And most of that wealth was generated off of stock trades, some of which were timed in a way that happened to coincide with congressional decisions, and you can draw your own conclusions or whatever. So in any event, there's a lot of us think we ought to just not be in the business of buying and selling individual stocks that bolster public confidence. And that's what this bill is aimed at doing. It makes some exceptions for, you know, we've got a handful of members who, for example, have done nothing wrong. They've owned a business prior to coming to Congress. They've sold it. They own stock as part of the sale, and you know, you can't really put them in a position. They can't sell their retirement income, for example, in order to generate living money. And so there are some minor exceptions like that, but generally I think this does a lot to bolster public confidence in the institution. I hope the Senate will pass it.
So that would mean if someone, you know, had a stock portfolio, that sort of thing, and if they were elected, then they would have to sell those or pass them basically to someone else?
Yeah, you can always, under current law, you can always put everything you have in a blind trust, and people have that option, and some people do. But under the new proposal, it would be flat-out illegal for members of Congress to purchase individual stocks. So you can never be in a position where you something's about to happen. I'm going to go out and buy stock in that because I think it's going to go up. In
sure.
terms of the sale of individual stocks that you already owned when you come to office, this is the issue of these people. I'm not in that position, but in the position of these people who have maybe sold a business beforehand and they own stock in that business under the new ownership as part of the sales agreement. And, you know, that's their retirement, or that's the source of their money. And so, you know, you can't really say you can't sell it. But it does require an advance notice period of, I think it's 5 or 6 days. So the idea is you can't get information and then just sort of quietly go, sell stock because you know its value is about to tank. You have to give public notice. You have to say, I'm going to sell this stock in a certain number of days. People have a chance to scrutinize it. There's a waiting period in there, so you can't take advantage of quick market swings. I think that's a reasonable compromise, but I think that the best provision is just a flat-out ban on ownership of stock by members of Congress, individual stocks.
Sure. No, that definitely makes sense. So we will see where that goes. So I know as well the House passed the Fiscal Year 2027 National Defense Authorization Act here earlier this week, and I know there's quite a few different things in that bill, but I understand there is going to be a pay raise for all active duty service members. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yes, and it's a little bit larger than it has been in recent years. We were able to do a pay raise for all active duty service members last year. It was modest, you know, it was a cost of living type of adjustment, but it's still moving in the right direction. But this year is different. The Defense Authorization Act that we just passed includes a tiered multi-level pay raise. It's a 5% across-the-board raise for all active-duty service personnel, which is larger than it has been in recent years. I think that's a, in and of itself, is a positive 5%. I think it's been about 3%, 2.5%, 3% in years past. But in addition, for the lowest ranking personnel, E1 through E5s generally, that increase is larger. It's a 7% increase. And, of course, those tend to be our lowest paid service members. They tend to be the ones that have the most difficulty making sure they can pay their bills every month. And so a larger raise for those folks was certainly in order. So, I mean, this doesn't solve all the problems with service members, you know, being in sort of a difficult financial position. But it really is a good step in the right direction, bigger than has been done in recent years. And I hope the first of several of these steps we can do in the coming years.
Very good. So that I know is definitely going to be appreciated for all those active duty service members. We're talking here with U.S. Representative Derek Schmidt here on the Mighty 690. And, sir, I know you've also been working on the Senator Robert J. Dole Greatest Generation Education Program. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm kind of excited about this provision. This is one of those things that it's fun to work on. I think it can make a difference. It's not world-changing, but it's, I think, a really positive thing. So the National World War II Memorial, it's on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Of course, that was one of Senator Dole's legacy projects. He was really the principal driver for getting that memorial authorized and raising the private money to build it and constructing it. It really is a great and long-overdue tribute to the men and women who served and fought in one world. There's a foundation that supports that memorial, raises money ongoing to kind of keep its maintenance and that sort of thing. And they approached me about working with them to set up, through the Department of Defense, a program that would support local efforts all over the country to carry on the memory and the legacy of the World War II generation, basically to tell the story so that our kids learn about the extraordinary sacrifice, unity, and courage that won World War II and sort of pulled this country together. I thought it was a great idea, and I told them I'd be glad to help with that on one condition, that we could name this program of telling the story of World War II for the next generation after Senator Dole, who, of course, you know, a great Kansan and somebody who was so closely associated with that generation and with the memorial. They thought it was a great idea. So we got the bill introduced. It's bipartisan. I'm the Republican lead. The Democrat lead is one of my colleagues from North Carolina. And we got that introduced, and it just passed out of the House. So now it's on its way to the Senate. I'm really hopeful it's going to become law this year. I'd like to claim credit for having planned this, but the truth is it was a coincidence. But we actually passed it out of the House on July 22nd, which would have been Senator Dole's 103rd birthday. So a little bit of positive irony there. So in any event, symbolism for Kansas, I think, is important. Or more important than that, the idea of making sure that we continue to support people telling that story so it doesn't die off and just become words on the page in a history book, that I think is really very important, and especially now when this country could use a little unity more than ever.
That's very good, and I think, you know, there's been some talk that the millennial generation can actually be that bridge, if you will, to help, you know, carry those stories, you know, from the World War II generation over to the next several generations, because they kind of bridge that gap and can kind of talk both languages there. So as you know, we unfortunately lose folks from that that World War II and Greatest Generation every day. So it is really important, I think, to carry that along, because that is such a pivotal moment in world history. And so I appreciate your efforts to make sure we continue that.
Appreciate it, James, very, very much.
All right. And then also, just as we get a little bit closer to wrapping up here, I know that you co-introduced the Able Match Act this week. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this deals with people with disabilities who are working toward independent living. It's already law, already, you know, well established that these ABLE accounts exist. They're special, federally authorized, tax-preferenced savings accounts that allow people with qualifying disabilities to save money, tax preference, plus the money saved there and spent out of there doesn't go toward their income thresholds in terms of qualifying for disability assistance or other forms of public help. So in other words, there's not a disincentive to save and try to be more independent, which there can be if you save money and you wind up, you know, losing your disability services. So ABLE accounts really, I think, are very positive. I've talked with a number of folks who use them, and they really provide a tool that can help support independence for people with disabilities over the course of a lifetime. That's law now. That's in effect. What our proposal does is for certain people who already qualify for ABLE accounts but are very low income, so saving for them can be very, very difficult. This creates a matching program. So, for particularly low-income people who are disabled, who are trying to be more independent, who choose to set up these special accounts to allow them to save for life needs, the federal government would match their contributions to those accounts up to a certain income limit. I think it's about $2,000 per year. Obviously, that's the right thing to do. It's the right public policy. You want to help and support people who need help but are trying to be increasingly independent. That's behavior and an outlook. You really want to support and reward. And so I was really pleased. I'm the Republican lead on that. My colleague who's leading it overall is Debbie Dingell out of Michigan. She's a Democrat. So it's a bipartisan effort. There's a bipartisan version of this bill pending in the U.S. Senate. And I'm really hopeful we can find a way to make it law. I think it can make a real difference for some folks.
We're speaking with U.S. Representative Derek Schmidt. And, sir, as we wrap up here, one more topic that just kind of came to mind here that, it's been the past now kind of month. We've really, even just this year has kind of been a theme of data centers being the topic of discussion here locally. And I really think this is probably more of a local and state issue. But I was just kind of curious, has there been much discussion at the federal level about data centers? I wouldn't necessarily expect, a lot of legislation per se, but I was just kind of curious if there's any buzz about data centers on Capitol Hill?
Well, there is a lot of discussion, and I agree with you. I think the vast majority of, people, when people talk with me about it, they're often worried about the siting decisions. Do we want one in our community? If so, what are the rules? What kind of water usages are going to be? What kind of power usage will there be? Where will the power come from? What's that mean for our rates? What's the tax benefit to the community? In other words, building the tax base, or is there a deferral? All those types of questions. Those tend to be either exclusively local decisions, as they would be with any proposed large investment coming to a community, or they are local and state, because state law governs all of those sorts of issues. The federal discussion tends to be a little bit different. Those issues come into play in the federal discussion, but then there's also the additional layer of, ultimately these data centers are giant computer storage facilities. They store enormous amounts of data, digital data, the stuff generated by all of our smartphones and all of our laptops and et cetera, all of those devices, daily life. And, these are being built in the first instance because we've never had these tools before, the most recent generations, and we certainly haven't had them in volume we have now. So there's just a lot more data that has to be stored. And there is a big public policy issue at the federal level about generally where the storage is going to occur. And I think most people tend to agree. We certainly want it to occur in friendly countries. You want it stored, physically stored in the United States or in a Canada or in an Australia, et cetera, et cetera. You don't want it to be stored in the People's Republic of China, for example, or in Russian Siberia. You don't want it to be stored in places where we have adversaries who would then control the physical storage of all of the data, daily life of Americans and others. So there's that additional wrinkle, but the actual siting decisions, do we want this in our community? That's a local decision, and I think should be.
Very good. Well, I appreciate you weighing in on that. It's always good to hear some additional perspective on that issue as we navigate it together. So, sir, anything else as we wrap up?
No, I appreciate the opportunity. Hopefully we'll get a little bit more meaningful rain, just enough to keep things green and growing, and look forward to being with you again next month.
Fantastic. Well, U.S. Representative Derek Schmidt, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us, and we'll look forward to chatting again soon.
Thanks, James. Take care.
All right. That is U.S. Representative Derek Schmidt here on the Mighty 690. We get to talk with him on the fourth Friday of every month at this time. Straight ahead, we'll have an update from Skank Insurance Sun Group and then some county fair information here. We have some interviews with some of those kids coming up at 9:30 from the Labette County Fair.